Hey folks, this is Chris Morse. I'm here at Red Hat, working on the brand team, but more importantly, working on the opensource.com team and helping bring you all these great webcasts over the past few months. Before we get started, I did want to mention that we do have some opportunities for you to follow the conversation outside of the webcast viewer today. You can follow us on Twitter at @OpenSourceWay and use our hashtag #OYWS. For those of you that might be new to opensource.com, opensource.com is a community of people exploring the principles of open source and how they can be applied to many areas even outside of the software community. Here at opensource.com, we love introducing our people and our community to other people that we think get it. We really think Daniel Pink is one of those people, and we are more than pleased to share him with you today and have him talk through some of his key principles from a number of his critically acclaimed books. As I mentioned, Daniel is the author of 4 books about changing the world of work, including the New York Times bestseller, A Whole New World, and what he'll be talking about today, Drive. Together, they've been translated in almost 32 languages. He lives in D.C. with his wife and 3 children, and most importantly, he has made some time to talk to us today. Daniel, I'll kick it over to you now, and you can take us through some of your ideas.
All right. Thank you, Chris, and thanks to everyone who has signed in through the magic of WebEx to be with us today. So what I want to do today is just talk a little bit about motivation, and then we'll open it up for some questions, because I think a lot of the people that they're involved connected in some way to opensource.com or connected in some way to Red Hat. They've got, they're already kind of ahead of the game in their sophistication about the understanding of motivation. So the problem here, I mean, one of the problems here is that when we talk about motivation or when someone, we tend to think that motivation, we have a kind of weird notions of it. On one hand, we say, you know, inside of companies or on athletic teams or in other kinds of realms, motivation is all about exhortation. You know, what I call the, and if you remember that Hungarian-American gymnastics coach, Bella Karoly, the "you can do it" school of motivation. And, you know, that stuff is fine, I guess, but I don't think it's very meaningful. I don't think that kind of external motivation really works in any kind of way. And so a lot of times in the business world, we think of motivation as, you know, okay, we're going to go hear from a great athlete who's going to tell you how he won the game with a walk-off home run in the bottom of the ninth, or you're going to hear from some person who climbed Mount Everest and dealt with all the trials and tribulations there. I decided that's not what I'm going to talk about here with you guys. What I want to do is talk about motivation from a very, very different perspective, which is the perspective of science. It turns out that over the last 50 years, a group of social scientists all over the world have taken a very, very hard-headed, rigorous look at what motivates us, especially at work, using laboratory experiments and field studies. They've tried to crack the code of what is it really that motivates us, especially to do good work. And what they have to say is a bit surprising. I think it'll be, again, less surprising to the folks assembled on this call. But I think in the world of more conventional business, it's very surprising. And here's a way to look at it. Obviously, human beings are complicated creatures. We all have a mix of motivation. So, you know, we all have a biological drive. We eat when we're hungry. We drink when we're thirsty. We have sex to satisfy our carnal urges. Okay? That drive, what I call, you can call it the first drive, that drive is a big part of what it is to be human. Okay? That's a hugely important part of what it is to be human. But none of us would ever say that's all it is to be human, because we're more complicated than that. We're more complex than that, because human beings also have a second drive, and that's the drive we do things because we get rewarded or punished for them. So a lot of things with regard to human behavior, if you reward the behavior, you're going to get more of that behavior. If you punish that behavior, you're going to get less of that behavior. So I'm sitting here in my office here, which is a converted garage in the back of my house, and, you know, I look at the doorknob to get out of here. If every time, let's not take the doorknob to get out of here. Let's just take the handle of one of my drawers. if every time I touched that drawer, I was punished, that is, I was shocked, I stopped touching the drawer, right? Okay, because I respond very well to, you know, we respond very well to rewards and punishment. If every time I touched that handle, I got, I don't know, some kind of electrical stimulus that made my brain feel good, or every time I touched that handle, a dollar was deposited in my bank account, I'd be touching that handle a lot. Okay, so that's a part of what it is to be human, the second drive, the drive to respond to rewards and punishments in our environment. That's also part of what it is to be human. And I don't think very many people would dispute that. But I don't think very many people would say that's all it is to be human, that human beings are merely this biological drive and this reward and punishment drive layered on top of it. Because we're more complicated than that. I mean, you are more complicated than that. And when I say you, I mean the people who are, you know, on this call right now, you know, as individuals. You are more complicated than that. You have another drive. You do things because they're interesting. You do things because they're meaningful. You do things because they contribute. You do things because they're the right thing to do. And that's a very important part of what it is to be human. So we have this kind of mix of drives. So here's the problem, and here's where we'll get into this. Early on, in the way that we organize economies and societies and so forth, the operating system, so to speak, the Linux, the Mac OS of societies was really built on that first drive. Okay, you know, early in human civilization, we were trying to survive. I was trying to outrace the saber-toothed tiger. I was trying to get past the, you know, elude the saber-toothed tiger and run faster than Chris so that I could survive and I don't really care what happens to him. This biological drive was the basis of society. You can think of that as an operating system. You can call it motivation 1.0. That's reasonably effective if the whole goal of life is survival, if you're living in tiny little units and you don't have much connection to outsiders. Well, eventually, we evolve. I don't mean evolve in the biological sense, although a little bit about biological evolution, but really our societies evolve. And so basing things on the biological drive doesn't make a lot of sense if you're doing trade with other clans, if you're working with people outside of your immediate, you know, tribal unit or your immediate family unit. And so we upgraded. We had a different operating system, and it was built on that second drive that I mentioned, that reward and punishment drive, the drive where we avoid punishment and we try to seek reward. And that was an incredible achievement. That was one of the most important inventions in human civilization, this idea that we could construct a system of rewards and punishments, and that would somehow grease the gears of commerce, grease the gears of social connection, grease the gears of efficiency. It was an incredible breakthrough. I don't think we human beings get enough credit for that. And that's what fueled the Industrial Revolution in many ways. Everyone says, hey, it was fueled by steam or coal or whatever, but it was really fueled as much by carrots and sticks. That's what allowed it to go. Well, the problem is that that kind of operating system, that operating system built on the reward and punishment drive, is not adequate for the work that people are doing today. It just doesn't work very well. And this is where I come back to the science. There's been 50 years of research in social science that says essentially this. And I'm not going to torture you with all the science. You can, you know, there's stuff online that you can find out. I know some handful of you have probably looked at the book. Here's what the science says over 50 years. If you want people to do relatively simple, straightforward kinds of tasks, straightforward kinds of work, what psychologists call algorithmic tasks, where you're following a set of rules, following a recipe, you know, barreling straight ahead toward a logical conclusion, turning the same screw on an assembly line, adding up columns of figures very quickly. Though the classic kind of motivator that we use in organizations, what I call an if-then motivator, if you do this, then you get that. If you do this, then you get that. Those kinds of motivators work pretty well. They get people to focus, eliminate distractions, barrel straight ahead. So again, those if-then motivators, if you do this, then you get that. They're pretty effective for the simple, algorithmic, rule-based kinds of turning the screw the same way so it's a task. Okay? And that's what motivation 2.0, built on that second drive, was all about. But 50 years in social science, and I'm happy to get into it in the Q&A. I don't want to torture anybody, you know, by going too deep into the science when it's available. You can find it elsewhere, and I'm happy to talk about it. 50 years in social science tells us that those if-then motivators, if you do this, then you get that, they're just not very effective for creative tasks, for complicated tasks, for complex tasks, where there isn't an algorithm that you have to follow, where there isn't a clear set of rules, where there isn't a clear set of ingredients, where you're trying to iterate something new, where you're trying to solve a problem with a non-obvious answer. For that kind of work, the more complicated, complex, creative sort of work, those if-then motivators just don't work very well. I mean, and what's frustrating about all this is that it's not even a close call in the social science. Social scientists started finding this out in the early 1960s. I mean, literally before I was born. And, you know, I'm not a young guy. I'm going to be, on my next birthday, I'm going to be 47 years old. Okay? So I'm like, you know, I hope half of my life still to live, but that means half of my life is over. Okay? So I'm not a spring chicken here. And this research began before I was born. Early 1960s. For 50 years, scientists, psychologists, sociologists, and later economists kept replicating this finding. And let me say it again at the risk of repeating myself ad nauseum. If-then rewards, they're good for the simple algorithmic sorts of tasks. They're not so good for the complicated, complex, and creative tasks. They just don't work very well. And so we have 50 years of science telling us this. And what the 50 years of science is telling us is that building our operating system for the sort of the set of rules and assumptions and protocols that run beneath our social relations and our economic activity, building that atop that second drive, the reward and punishment drive, isn't going to work. And this is one reason we have, I mean, I don't want to take the metaphor too far, but I don't think it's accidental that we have an operating system that, or an economy that keeps crashing in various ways, because what we have is it's running a set of programs that are much more advanced than the operating system is allowed. And what we need to do is we need to upgrade that operating system from motivation 2.0, built on that second drive, the reward and punishment drive, and make it built on that third drive, which is this internal drive, that drive, as I mentioned, to do things because you like them, because they're interesting, because they're satisfying, because they contribute. And it's really what we really want for high performance on those kinds of tasks, those non-routine, non-algorithmic tasks, is companies and organizations that build themselves around this sort, that drive, rather than the second drive. And what's a little bit frustrating here, and forgive me because I can see I can sort of feel the register of my voice climbing here a little bit. What's frustrating about all of this is that when we see these second drive, motivation 2.0, motivators, these if-then motivators, fail. When we see them fail before our very eyes, many times we don't say, hey, they failed again, those motivate, those carrots and sticks. Let's try something different. Instead, we say, man, those carrots and sticks failed again. I guess that means we need a lot more carrots. I guess that means we need sharper sticks poked more savagely into people. And essentially, people have taken the message of seeing these carrot and stick motivators not work and concluded that we're not doing it enough. We're not doing it with enough intensity. We need to double down. But the problem is that they don't work. And so intensifying something that is flawed isn't going to get you the answer. What we need is, again, to use this operating system metaphor, is an upgrade in the operating system to motivation 3.0, which is built on this third drive, this more internal drive. Now, what does that mean? Okay, so that's sort of at the high theoretical conceptual plane here. Let's talk about what that means specifically. And I want to give you some examples of how this comes to life. And, you know, as many of them from software as I can. So what this means is that if you want people to do, if you want high performance on these more complicated tasks, which is what most people are doing, if you're in a paid environment, if you're in a four-pay job, you have to do a few things. But let me just say one thing about open source. The amazing thing about open source as a phenomenon is that, and I've said this before in other kinds of contexts, is that not too long ago, people would have looked at the very proposition of open source and said, no, that is theoretically impossible. That is a fantasy. That is simply not possible. It's no more possible than me, you know, walking out of my office here in Washington, D.C. and levitating into the air, defying gravity. So this idea that a group of people around the world with advanced, you know, often with very, very sophisticated skills, who have jobs typically, would use their discretionary time to do complicated, difficult work for free and then give away their product would have seemed absurd not too long ago. It would have been ridiculous in a way. It would have been, telling an economist that would have been like telling a physicist, hey, you know what? I know we talked about the law of gravity and everything, but or the first law of thermodynamics or whatever, but hey, you know what? That doesn't apply in my backyard. My backyard doesn't, the law of gravity is not enforced. So in my backyard, we can just float into the air. You know, in my backyard, a body in motion doesn't stay in motion unless it's acted on by an outside force. You know, they would say, what? You're fantasizing. You're crazy. But open source, this idea that people would do complicated, difficult work for no money and give away their product for free would have seemed preposterous. And this is a sign of the inadequacy of this motivation 2.0 approach. We need to have this three-dimensional view of human beings rather than this two-dimensional view. Now, what does this three-dimensional view look like? Again, if you look at the science and what does it yield? Let's talk about work in a paid environment, because I don't want to suggest that, oh, everything should be open source, that we should have armies of volunteers doing all of our work. I just don't think that's, I don't think that's right. So when it comes to work, let me be very simple here. When it comes to work, what's really key here? You got to pay people enough. So this doesn't mean that money never matters in any kind of context. That's ludicrous. In a paid work environment, you got to pay people enough. Money is a very important motivator, but just not in the way that we think. What's really key is that you got to honor the norm of fairness. Human beings are exquisitely attuned to the norm of fairness. And so if you violate that, you're toast. What does that mean? People evaluate fairness in paid employment in two different dimensions. Number one, they evaluate it internally. So let's say that Chris and I are working at a company and we're doing comparable amounts of work, comparable contribution to the company, basically comparable set of skills, comparable contributions to the company, maybe even comparable amounts of experience. And I find out, or Chris finds out, that I'm getting paid 20% more than he is. That is profoundly demotivating for Chris, because it's not fair. If Chris and I, say, are working as programmers for a certain size company, let's say in Northern Virginia, here in the D.C. technology region here, if we're a certain kind of programmer with a certain set of experience, a certain level of contribution, and we find out that other companies, similar companies to the one we're working for, are paying their software engineers who have the same amount of experience, the same talent level, the same amount of contribution, if we find out that those companies are paying more than our companies, profoundly demotivating because it's not fair. Okay, so the key is to pay people enough. In some ways, to pay people enough to take the issue of money off the table. So they're not focused on the money, they're focused on the work. Now, let me just drop a footnote here very quickly and talk about one very interesting piece of economic research. There was an interesting study that actually involved software programmers, software professionals, and other tech professionals. There was a study done by a guy who ended up winning the Nobel Prize in economics, that showed that in Silicon Valley, people, this is not in the sort of current hothouse of Silicon Valley, this is 25 years ago, but in most cases, if you were to say, we can usually predict the range that someone's going to get. So if you say a programmer with this, who can program in these kinds of languages, who has this amount of experience, who's working for this kind of company in, say, Raleigh-Durham area, we can predict what that person's going to earn, okay? So let me that person's going to, I don't know what the labor market there would bear, but let's say, you know, between $100,000 and $120,000. What he noticed is that there were some firms that were paying, let's say the range was $100,000 to $120,000 for that particular job. What he noticed is that there were some firms out there, some companies out there, they were paying $130,000 or $135,000. They could have gotten people to get take the job for $120,000, but they were overpaying, which seems ludicrous. But it turned out that those were the companies that ended up performing at the highest level. And so what they were doing, in a way, was paying people enough to take the issue of money off the table. So that's what really That's the best use of money as a motivator. Dangling it out in front of people as a motivator isn't all that effective. What does work? Three things. Autonomy, mastery, and purpose. Autonomy, mastery, and purpose. Autonomy, mastery, and purpose. Autonomy is self-direction. That is, if you want people to engage, which is what we want for the creative, conceptual, complicated work that most of us are doing, if you want people to engage, you don't manage them. You don't incentivize them. You don't control them. What you do is you give them the freedom to get there on their own. And so what this means is that you need to give people enormous amounts of autonomy, or not enormous, but more autonomy over what they do, how they do it, when they do it, where they do it, who they do it with. And there's some interesting examples, many of them from software, that are showing, taking this radical approach to autonomy. Let me give you three quick ones here. So one of my favorites, maybe my favorite of all time, is this company this company Atlassian, which many of you are familiar with, the Australian software company. And they do something amazingly cool. They do something that is, I think, a true innovation in practice. And they do something that dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of companies around the world have started doing themselves. And that's what's called a FedEx Day. And here's what they do. Once a quarter on a Thursday afternoon, they say to their software developers, go work on anything you want as long as it's not part of your regular job. Anything you want for the next 24 hours. Do whatever you want, wherever you want it, whoever you want it with. The only thing we ask is that you show what you've created at the end of those 24 hours in this fun, freewheeling meeting. You show what you've created to the rest of the company in this kind of wacky, fun meeting. They call these things FedEx days because you have to deliver something overnight. It turns out that this one day of intense, undiluted autonomy has led to a whole array of fixes for existing software, a whole array of ideas for new products, a whole array of improvements to how the company does business that had otherwise never emerged. Now, you see on your screen right there, this dude who's grasping for the carrot. That's what we think motivates people to do great work, that if we just dangle that carrot out in front of people, they'll respond. And this is not that approach. This is not saying, hey, if you do something amazing, I'll give you a carrot. It's saying we hire good people want to do amazing things. What if we just get out of their way for a day? Very different approach to motivation, a 3.0 approach to motivation. Let's take a company like Facebook. Facebook hires, very rigorous hiring, hires software engineers, programmers. They put them in a Facebook boot camp, and then they do something that's kind of amazing, something that hasn't gotten a lot of notice. In the course of this Facebook boot camp, the engineers whom they hire will interview with various teams around the company, various product teams, various technology teams. And then at the end of those interviews, after a couple of weeks, the individuals will decide where they want to work. Think about that for a second. The company picks the talent, but the talent picks the team. Okay, so if you have more autonomy over your team, you're more likely to engage. And I think that's one of the secrets of open source, is that you have, I think, a greater affiliation and a little bit more autonomy over who you work with, as opposed to many companies where you basically just inherit all of your teammates. So that's another software example. Let me give you yet another software example. Let's take Intuit, the big software maker. Now, Intuit is dealing with, like all of you, who I'm assuming a large portion of you are involved in software. I mean, one of the amazing things about software is how quickly the platform changes. And Intuit is platforms change. So Intuit is dealing with that. So, they used to sell software in shrink-wrapped boxes. They're quick enter TurboTax. It seems archaic, even though, people were still doing it, like in 2007. But they say, okay, crap, we can't do that anymore. People want to be able to download it. Everybody has broadband. They want to be able to download it onto their computer. And so they switched the way that they delivered their software to being downloadable onto laptops and desktop computers. Okay, great, problem solved. Then, a couple of years later, what happened? People say, hey, I want Quicken on my iPad. I want TurboTax on my Android. And suddenly they have to come up with a way to deliver it on an entirely new platform. Now, what's interesting is that Intuit does something called 10% time, which many of you might be familiar with more broadly, 10% time. Well, people at Intuit, some people at Intuit can spend 10% of their time working on whatever they want, Now, again, Intuit's not signing away the intellectual property rights to what's created during that 10% time, which is smart. So I did an interview with the head of innovation at Intuit, a guy named Roy Rosen, and he said to me, after the CEO declared that mobile was, key to the company's future, the team of people doing on 10% funds created 7 mobile apps before the official mobile projects even got funded. Okay, so that shows you the power of autonomy. And there's all kinds of things that we can do inside of organizations to enhance autonomy. I'm happy to talk about it more in the Q&A. There's a very simple kind of audit that you can do that takes about 60 seconds to get a sense of how much autonomy you have, how much autonomy your teammates have. I'm a big fan of trying these FedEx days. I think that they're a huge idea, and they're spreading like wildfire. And there are a variety of other kinds of tactical, simple things that you can do to give people a little bit more sovereignty over your time, their team, their task, and their technique, and that leads to higher performance. Second, we've got autonomy, mastery, and purpose. Autonomy, mastery, and purpose. Mastery is our desire to get better at stuff. We like to get better at stuff because we like to get better at stuff. It's inherently satisfying. There's some research out of Harvard Business School that showed that making progress is the single biggest motivator at work. The single biggest motivator at work is making progress in your work. And I think that that's a big attraction to open source, so that people can actually see the consequences of what they do. They can, in contrast of giant bureaucracies where people do stuff and it disappears into the ether, they can make a contribution. They can do something that matters. And they can see, more important, they can see the results of what they do. And I think that's a big problem inside of organizations, most organizations, is that we know from some great work by Teresa Mobley at Harvard University that making progress is the single biggest motivator at work. But in many ways, the architecture of our companies especially isn't set up to help people make progress, to put people in positions where they make progress, to help people see their progress, to recognize their progress. And that's largely because progress depends on feedback. And the workplace, as all of you know, is incredibly feedback deprived. I mean, we live in a world of incredible rich feedback. I mean, rich, regular, rapid feedback. I can look on this WebEx event panel and I can see, hey, has anybody dropped off? You know, is anybody tuning out? We started with 100 participants. We now have 99. And, you know, and now if we started with 100 and we suddenly had 34, I'd say, that's an interesting feedback I'm getting on how valuable this is. Now, it's ironically, you just dropped to 98. Maybe we don't want to hear about feedback. The key here is that the workplace is very, very feedback deprived. The rest of our lives are rich in feedback. In the workplace, we give people feedback in annual performance reviews, which is a freaking joke. I mean, nobody gets better at anything if they get feedback on their performance once a year. And so what we need to do is come up with ways to enrich the feedback environment inside of organizations, to increase the feedback metabolism. All kinds of ways to do that. You can have people do their own performance reviews. There's a very interesting set of things going on out there with regard to peer-to-peer feedback, where peers can give each other feedback, or peers can even give each other after-the-fact, unexpected, cash prizes, too. There's also, again, I know many of you are interested in software, there's some very interesting new software coming out that is out that's designed to use software to, bring the metabolism of feedback inside a firm up to the level that it is in the rest of our lives. So that's mastery, autonomy, mastery. And then finally, purpose, is that people do what they do better and why they're doing things, when they know what the point of the exercise is. There's, again, as I mentioned, there's some very, very interesting research in this regard that even simple things like I give you the scholar's name. There's a great scholar of this named Adam Grant at Wharton who's done a lot of research in this. And essentially what he's found is that giving people just a simple reminder of why they're doing what they're doing can dramatically increase their performance. So if you have people raising money for a university, reading letters from people who had benefited from the money raised there, getting a scholarship or funding scientific research or something like that, simply reading a few minutes of letters, reading letters literally for a few minutes before making fundraising calls that sort of testify to the purpose of the exercise, it had a huge impact on performance. He did a very interesting study with lifeguards. In lifeguards who read stories about lifeguards doing, saving people's lives or contributing to their community you know, sort of like what it is it to be a lifeguard, they did a lot better in their work. They were much more likely to come back the next year. They were much more likely, I think, to do kind of further training and things like that. And so, you know, human beings are really thirsting for context. Well, I'll tell you one quick anecdote and then sort of bring this to a close and we'll take some questions. A long time ago, over a decade ago, or 10 years plus ago, I wrote a book called Free Agent Nation. And that was a book about the rise of people working for themselves. And what I did to write that book is I traveled around the United States interviewing hundreds and hundreds of people who had decided to leave large organizations to go out on their own, I did these very long qualitative interviews with people to get a sense of what their lives were about. And what, and I'm happy to say, for those of you interested, that that book remains in print 10 years later. It sells tens of copies every year. It's got my royalty statement. Tens of copies every year. So, and so what the people told me, though, in these interviews, again, these very long, in-depth, qualitative interviews, was they kept using the same word. They kept saying, hey, I felt I wasn't making a contribution. That's the word I kept hearing. I wasn't making a contribution. And what that meant as they unpacked it was they were willing to work, but in a lot of especially large organizations, they didn't see how what they did each day contributed. That is, they would do stuff, but kind of nothing would happen. It was sort of alienating. I mean, there's this, you know, it's not, I don't think it's an accident. If you look at, say, the Greek mythology, that great source of management wisdom, you know, when someone wanted to be, one dude wanted to be, was punished by Zeus, a guy named Sisyphus. His job was to push a you know, huge boulder up a hill, and every time he came back the next day, it had gone back down. That is, he made no progress. He didn't have any kind of contribution in what he did, and that was deemed like a way to punish evil doing more than sending him to Hades. You know, more than physically torturing him, was to put him in a position where what he did didn't matter. And I think that's how, not nearly as deeply, I think that's how some people felt. And so in organizations that are animated by a purpose, or people, this purpose of the small p and purpose of the capital P, but if the people know basically the point of the exercise and why they're doing what they're doing, they'll do better. But when people have a purpose that kind of transcends the bottom line, that's more transcendent, more significant than let's raise earnings per share 4 cents this quarter, then they do better. And I think what's going on, and I think what the open source movement reflects, is that, you know, we've relied too long as on the profit motive as the motivator. Too long on the profit motive as the motivator. The profit motive is a good thing. I mean, it's a good thing for, I think it's a good thing morally in many, many ways. I think it's a great thing for efficiency. But it's not the only thing, because people aren't only motivated by the profit motive. More and more of us are animated by what you might call the purpose motive, this idea that any kind of group of people, whether it's a company, whether it's a nonprofit organization, whether it's a movement, that is, it's higher functioning if it stands for something and contributes to the world. Now, that's always been true for social movements and always tried to be true for nonprofits, but I think it's becoming more true of private sector companies. That is, the higher performing companies are companies that are, you know, doing something and contributing to the world. And I think the more that we can surface that purpose motive in our lives, the purpose motive which is very much behind the open source movement, the more I think we can do better in all realms. And then just to say one last word, if you look at, you know, Linux or Wikipedia or Apache or, you know, so many of these, Ubuntu, you know, so many of these open source kinds of ventures, they're very much grounded in these principles. People have the opportunity to direct their own lives. People do it in part because they get better at something that matters. They get feedback on their work from people they respect. And they're doing it with a sense of purpose. They know how their piece contributes, and they know that the enterprise itself is something valuable and meaningful and that has an impact on the world. And so I really think that open source offers a lot of clues for how to run actual non-open source companies a little bit better. I think it offers a lot of clues about what really motivates us. I think it offers a lot of clues about the content of that third drive. And I think it gives us a points us to a future that I think is going to be, I truly think it's going to be more efficient, but also better in every respect. So let me wrap up there and take your questions, because we're now up to 107. So
yeah,
that's a 7% increase. A 7% increase in the last 4 minutes.
That's feedback. So I don't know. That's definitely feedback. I don't know if it was you feeding me to a tiger, or you know, you telling everyone I don't get paid enough. But we got a lot of more folks in the room, so that is definitely good feedback. So I think the great questions that we got actually at registration, a lot of them actually talk about the ways in which, you know, a lot of people agree. They definitely, it struck a chord. They see motivation 3.0 as something that needs to be addressed. But I think a lot of questions began or kind of came up along the lines of, you know, what's that first step, or how, you know, if you're not a manager or decision maker, how do you kind of activate your organization, and really how do you arm us to be kind of motivation 3.0 ambassadors?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a really important question. I think what's interesting to what's interesting to understand is that a lot of the really cool, groovy initiatives inside of these companies, actually, almost none of them started from the top. almost all of them kind of started from the middle, from the kind of people who are asking this question. And I think it's a really, really important point, because I think it's possible to look at this set of ideas and say, and get that kind of, and have the kind of response, Chris, that you just mentioned. Hey, yeah, I agree. But here's the thing. I'm not in charge. I can't, you know, can I change my whole company, my whole organization? And so if you ask yourself, can I change the whole organization? The answer is no, you can't. You can't. But I think that's the wrong question. I think the real question is that sort of corollary that you were mentioning, which is, you know, can I do one small thing tomorrow or this week to make things a little bit better? And I think that you can. And let me give you an example of that. One of the interesting super autonomous forms of work that's emerging out there is this thing called the results-only work environment, the ROWE, the R-O-W-E, ROWE. This is something where people don't have schedules. They don't have to be in the office at a certain time or any time. They just have to get their work done. Meetings are optional. Now, this is kind of a radical approach. It's now being, so the best example of this is at the corporate headquarters of Best Buy, the big American retailer. They have this giant corporate headquarters in Richfield, Minnesota, that I think has, I don't know, maybe 4,500 employees, somewhere around there. 90% of the people at this big corporate headquarters, again, this is a big company, publicly held company, 90% of the people at this company are on a results-only work environment. That's pretty remarkable. And it's had huge improvements in, I mean, it's stopped a huge amount of attrition in the company. Satisfaction scores are up, engagement scores are up, productivity arguably is up. I mean, it's been a big success, basically saying, hey, get your work done. How you do it is up to you. Results-only work environment. Now, we've got 90% of the company doing it. How did this start? Did the CEO say, hey, we're going to be a results-only work environment? No way, not even close. What happened is that a couple of young women, two young women in human resources in one division of the company, started doing this because they couldn't stand the way that the status quo was working. So they started saying to their colleagues in a particular division, you know what, come in whenever you want. Okay, just don't tell anybody. Get your work done, but we're not going to monitor, you know, what time you're here, when you leave, or all that kind of stuff. Get your work done. If you don't, you're in big freaking trouble. But how you do it, when you do it, is completely up to you. And so this becomes, out of frustration with the existing policies, they're kind of implicit policy. They don't make a big deal out of it. Cut, fade out. You know, about a year later, the big brass are looking at the results of the various divisions in this company. And they notice this one division is on fire. Very little, you know, attrition has stopped, engagement is up, satisfaction is up, this division is on fire. The execs go down to see what's going on. And they go to these two young women who finally say, hey, we're kind of sort of letting people come in whenever they want. And some execs would have said, that must stop immediately, it's a violation of our policy. But these execs said, oh, really, tell us about this. maybe we should try it somewhere else. They tried it in another division. It worked. And then it basically spread to the whole company. And so I think that the key principle here in response to that question is to, as I said, not, don't ask yourself, can I change the whole organization? You can't. But ask yourself, can I do one thing tomorrow or this week that'll make things better? And I think you can. I think you have those ideas. And I think the real secret is just to go do them. Not to ask for permission about them, but to go do them. To be a little subversive. But not subversive in a crazy anarchic sense, but to practice what you might think of as strategic subversion. Strategic subversion. Where you do something because you think strategically it's a good move. You don't do anything crazy. You don't do anything, you know, you don't put all your chips on one, you know, one number. But you try something. You don't make a big deal out of it. If it works, if it doesn't work, you don't say anything about it. If it does work, you tell other people about it. And when you trace back some of these really, these things that sound so groovy and forward thinking, that's often how they start. One or two people, often in the middle, got just disgusted with the status quo and said, hey, let's try something a little bit different. Let's subvert the system a little bit, but not in a crazy anarchist way, in a way that is smart and shrewd and sensible, and let's see if it works. And that actually weirdly has a kind of catalytic role sometimes in catalyzing change more broadly. So I hope that that is helpful. Also, again, there are a whole bunch of other, a lot of this is online, so I just want to be sure that I'm not flacking this book Drive. But in the final sections of Drive is a whole toolkit that has tools and tips and exercises and other kinds of ideas for how to sort of do things, just how to get stuff, you know, how to do something. And you can find a lot of that on my website, danpink.com. You can also find it other places online. It happens to be in the book, too, but you can, you know, if you want to get it for free, you can definitely find that.
Nice, thanks. Yeah, so I think a lot of the questions that did come in around that, they did have some elements of fear or, you know, how do I do this without getting in trouble, things like that. So I think that is helpful. Your answer was very helpful. And I think the reason.
Yeah. And I think that, and, you know, here's the thing. It's like, you know, I mean, there's some people, you know, I think you have to triangulate between sort of two different positions. One of them is, you know, damn the torpedoes, break all the china, do whatever you have to do, you know, that kind of sort of exhortative, who cares what other people think, that, you know, and I just think that's not realistic. And I think the other one is, okay, don't do anything, you can't do anything, you're going to get in trouble. I think there's a way to triangulate those two positions with strategic subversion and say, what can I get away with that is strategic? And let me just try this. And again, if it works, you say something about it. If it doesn't work, don't say anything about it. The other thing is that I'm not joking about that. I mean, yeah. that's how a lot of this change happens. The other thing is that when you go and make the case to, you know, if you end up having to make the case to the people at the top, the people with a little bit more formal authority, and in many cases, I have to say, I think we've, inside of organizations, we've oversold the power of formal authority and undersold the power of kind of informal influence as a way to get things done. And in some cases, the fear of the formal authority is often an excuse for not doing something that someone knows she can do, but just doesn't have the gumption to do it. But if you end up going in and making the case to the people at the top, the people with that formal authority, always, 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 always make the case on results, not on the inputs. So if you want more autonomy, don't lead with autonomy. Don't say, hey, I think we need some more autonomy over here, some more sovereignty over the various aspects of our work life. Bah! Don't do that. Go in there and say, hey, I've got this great idea for how we can increase productivity. I've got this great idea for how we can deliver better results for our customer. And because a lot of these sorts of things, here's the thing, the smart companies are taking these notions of autonomy, mastery, and purpose and using them in very hard-headed, very strategic ways. The problem that you sometimes face is that superficially, they sound a little soft. They sound a little woo-woo. And so you don't lead with that. Lead with, hey, I've got an idea for how to come up with, you know, more good ideas in this company. I've got an idea for how to increase our productivity. I've got an idea for how we can, boost production, you know, to lead with the results and emphasize the results and then kind of smuggle in these unorthodox ways as your path to doing that.
Yeah, I think a lot of the other questions that came up kind of talked about, you know, how do you sustain some of that? You know, how do you kind of start with that mission and really kind of, again, try to be a catalyst, kind of try to move your small part of the world, but then how do you keep that sustained motivation and any other inhibitors that might come in to start with basic motivation? But another one that came up kind of as a caveat to that question, for the entrepreneurs out there that are looking to leave current jobs and try to follow their real motivations if they lie with outside the companies that they might be at, again, right, what are the inhibitors there? How do you kind of get past that and maybe stay more focused towards your true motivation?
Yeah. Okay, well, those are two kind of interesting sets of questions. They're not the first one had to do with how do you sustain it. And
yeah,
that's a good question. And I think that's true. I think that's a broader organizational challenge. You know, if you come up with something new and innovative, people over time will metabolize it. And any sort of thing, you know, so if you have, we're going to reconfigure the physical workplace to make it more productive, and then you see this big kind of boost, you know, you might see this big boost initially, and then people get used to being in this kind of workplace and they revert. So I think that's actually a really good challenge. And I don't think there's an easy answer for that one.
No.
I think there's an easier answer for how do you do one thing, which is basically do one thing. And I think that a way to do that is to, in some ways, pass the baton a little bit. So that if you're the person who catalyzed this at the beginning, you know, if you can build other people who are into it and other people who believe in it, that maybe you can pass the baton to them to come up with a different way to sustain it, or not even to sustain, but to recatalyze. I think it's difficult if you're the one who comes in and says, hey, I'm going to do the strategically subversive thing, and holy smokes, it worked, and now more people are doing it. Okay, and then, you know, it's working really well, and it's become kind of commonplace. I think, you know, for yourself as an individual, it's helpful to have colleagues and peers who you can say, listen, you know, I don't know, I'm not sure what to do next. What do you think? And pass the baton to them. That's a very difficult challenge, though, in general. I don't think there's an easy answer to it. On the entrepreneurial thing, that's another tough one. It sort of depends on where you are. I sort of believe in it's sort of a first cousin of strategic subversion, which is, and I think this is true for entrepreneurs. The good entrepreneurs are new to this. Again, we have this notion that entrepreneurs are these kind of wild and woolly, crazy people who dive out of airplanes and stick their heads in the mouth of a big lion. When in fact, they're kind of strategic, calculated risk takers. And I think that's how you approach it. And so, I think there's something to be said. Again, depending on your employment agreement, you see a lot of people doing a version of moonlighting or even sunlighting if they're doing it, you know, doing it during the day. So you try something in a very small, modest way on the side, that is, don't abandon your job entirely, but, you know, experiment or try small versions of what you hope to do on the side in a moonlighting kind of way. I think that can often be a helpful kind of transition. The other thing is, I mean, easier for people who are married or who, again, not to get political about this, or who live in states where you're actually allowed to marry the person you want to marry, you know, what I did, I mean, when I look at this, you know, I left my regular job. I'm coming up on my 14th anniversary of leaving my job. And hey, thank you. You can send me a card if you want, Chris. Yeah. Or flowers or chocolate, whatever you want. There are some M&Ms that spell out Free Agent Nation. When I left my job, you know, all those years ago, I'm married, and my wife didn't leave her job. Okay? So it's easier if you have a spouse, and you can sort of make an agreement within your family unit saying, hey, listen, I'm going to try this. You're not going to give up your regular job. You're not going to give up your health insurance, and we'll see how this works. So any kind of calculated risk-taking, I think, makes a lot of sense. But what I worry about, though, is the number of people out there who are waiting for, okay, I'll, you know, basically in their heads they're saying, I want to do this. I want to do something else. I want to launch. I want to, use Seth Godin's great expression, I want to ship, want to do something different. And they essentially wait for the perfect conditions and the ideal environment for that to happen. And they're going to be waiting forever. The ideal situation, the ideal circumstances, the perfect environment doesn't exist. And so, like so many things in life, you can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And so you have to look for, okay, what's a good time to do this? Because you're not going to get a perfect time to do it. What's a good time to do it? And just try that. The other thing that I think there's a lot of strategy here. Obviously, if you can save up some money so you have a little bit of a cushion, I think you need to think through the worst case scenario. The worst case scenario often is that you just flop and you go back and get a job, which is really not that bad. In many ways, for many people, it's not different from the status quo. And the other way that I like to look at these kinds of things is, again, I don't want to get all woo-woo on you in the waning minutes here, but is to imagine yourself at 90 years old, thinking back on your life, looking at what you're proud of, look at what you regret. And what would your 90-year-old self tell you right now? That is, would your 90-year-old self have more regrets for going out and taking this chance and failing, or not taking a chance at all? And I think for most of us, not everybody, our 90-year-old self is going to urge us to just try it and see what happens.
Yeah, I think a lot of the things that we've talked about so far, I think really we've focused on a lot of the opportunities that are out there, so opportunities that, you know, give us ways to change where we are, change our certain position, improve. I think our question that came in, and, you know, we can answer it quickly and end on a more positive question too, but I did want to address it. What is the way to kind of carry over some of these theories of motivation in times where there are cutbacks and reductions, and manage folks that are, you know, either having a reduction in salary or they're being let go? You know, kind of how does that come into play? Kind of especially in the past couple of years. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think that's a really, really important question, and I think you can actually look at it in two different ways. Number one is you can say, you know, it depends on. It's interesting to talk about the frontline employees and the managers and how they look at this. A lot of the frontline employees are understandably very nervous, and that makes absolute sense in this kind of economy where the Fed today said, we're downgrading our view of where the economy is going. And by the way, we're completely out of tools about how to juice things. Thanks. So 9.1% unemployment. It's bad, man. I mean, it's really bad. So if you might say, that's nice, Dan. You can just, you can yammer about strategic subversion, but I need to keep my job. And that's very understandable. I think what you can do is you can do things that maybe are a little bit less instantly subversive and try to, where you can on your own, sculpt your own job to make it a little bit more autonomous and a little bit more meaningful. So there are things that you can do, for instance, on your own. Let's talk about feedback for a second. You could do I'm a big fan of what I call do-it-yourself performance reviews, where at the beginning of the month you set out your goals, and at the end of the month, you basically call yourself into the office and give yourself an evaluation. Where are you making progress? Where are you falling behind? That's the kind of thing that has absolutely no threat to your existence in your job, but it's a way to make the job a little bit richer in feedback. What I also see going on, certainly in software and in other sorts of things where the work is team-based, is teams doing this sort of thing. Teams giving each, meeting, setting out their goals, coming back and giving each other feedback, or even come up with a group of peers who do this kind of thing. So I think on the feedback you can enrich your job even if there are cutbacks, even if your salary is stagnant, and you can do it in a way that doesn't threaten your livelihood, something like that. The other thing that is very interesting is that I hear from managers is this. Listen, my people are incredibly demotivated. We've had cutbacks. People are scared. And they're not like the evil boss of Dilbert. They're saying, what can I do? And I think that if you have an honest conversation with the managers, I think that in some kind of counterintuitive way, that a moment like this is a moment where managers might, looking at this demotivated staff, might say, let's try something that doesn't cost money. So a FedEx day doesn't cost money. Letting people work from home one day a week doesn't necessarily cost money. Coughing up a little bit of money for, you know, peer-to-peer, after-the-fact, unexpected reward. So I see you do something awesome, I can give you an award, you know, give you a 50-buck prize. I think managers are really searching for things because they see this demotivation out there, and they recognize that, like, they're out of carrots, okay? And so maybe they have to start – and I hear from them all the time, how can I turn to some of these internal motivators during this time? So I guess the big point here is that if you're an individual contributor, your manager might not be as far away from you as you think in how he or she looks at this.
So we are at the top, about to be at the top of the hour, but I want to give you a chance to kind of end. I know that was a tough question to end kind of on a high note. What are some, for the managers that are joined in, I think we're still hovering 100 folks, as you mentioned before, the managers, individual contributors, what's kind of your last drive, call to arms before we sign off today?
You know, it really goes to that one question, Chris, which is, you know, don't set yourself up for failure by saying, I'm going to change everything. Just say, yeah, I'm going to do one thing in my own realm to make it a little bit better. And I really think people can do that. And I really think that in many cases, the fear of organizational resistance to these things is a little bit overstated. That, you know, I know that as individuals, and many times, especially in a crappy environment like this, we're feeling a little bit nervous, we're feeling a little bit vulnerable. But the truth is that organizations themselves and the people at the top share that. Like, they're a little bit wigged out. They're a little fearful. So, you know, in those kinds of situations, depending on the set of personalities and things, there's often a kind of, you know, there can be a receptivity to doing things a little bit, to doing things, very small things a little bit differently. And so this is, you know, it's sort of analogous to why we see, especially in huge downturns, why we see the birth of a lot of new operations in huge downturns is that... And so I think it's analogous. I think people should be cautiously optimistic and pragmatically radical about these approaches, but also recognize that there could be greater organizational receptivity here than you expect. I have to say, from my email and folks contacting me, well, there are a lot of organizations out there, from big companies to small companies to nonprofits, are searching for how to do things a little bit better.
Yeah. Well, Daniel, this has been, I mean, we have so many questions we didn't even get to. This has been incredible, though. It's been so great to have you join us today. We will have a recap article posted on opensource.com shortly,
great,
not already. And we also will have an on-demand version of our talk today, just so folks can log in and, you know, that either couldn't join for whatever reason today or want to take out some of those key points that they heard. Again, really just want to thank you. I'll be sure to send out any questions that we had that we weren't able to answer. And also thank all the folks that joined today. It was, you know, the dialogue that we had, again, as Daniel mentioned at the beginning, is really important to why we have these webcasts. So I want to thank everyone for logging in and sustaining. There were a lot of folks that were in there the whole time, so it was great to have you. Daniel, thanks again.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me. Thanks everybody, for spending an hour of your afternoon with us.
Awesome. Thanks again.
Okay.